Welcome back, readers and romance seekers, to Hopelessly Romantic Behind the Page. I hope you are having a lovely beginning to your spring. I know I still feel like I am drowning with all the rain that we have been getting. And for me, thankfully, I've managed to escape April Fool's without much strife. Well, almost, I guess. I'll just go ahead and come out and say that I honestly loathe April Fool's Day. I've never enjoyed pranks in general. I just tell all my friends and family, is like, please do not do anything for me or with me on April Fool's Day. The only time I'm really okay with it is like if it's a group prank and everyone gets to laugh, like, you know, like a sort of candid camera kind of thing. But even then, I'm still not a big fan. And I didn't notice actually until just this very moment that technically I pranked myself last week. So yeah, this is a roundabout way to talking about the princess plan one last time. I swear on my life that I genuinely had no idea that A, this was a Harlequin novel, and B, that it was a Victorian romance. It happened just like I said in the episode last week. I settled in for what I thought might be a modern royal romance, and then I got smacked with the words London, 1845. I promise, on my soul, I did not know until that moment. It's probably safe to say that yes, I can be a little unobservant at times. This has gotten me into trouble on some occasions. No, I will not be going in depth on an explanation for that. So I felt slightly annoyed that I tricked myself, basically that's what happened, into a historical romance from Harlequin, no less. It's not that I'm leaving Harlequin entirely, I promise, but since I wanted to read actual erotic romance for the podcast, Harlequin cannot deliver on that requirement. And when I was making the purchase that included the princess plan for this next round of books, there was already historical romance in the lineup, and I didn't feel the need to add another one. I am trying to keep up some variety with what we go into. If we really want to get into it, this is a big example why the phrase "don't judge a book by its cover" exists. But the cover still has an important job when it comes to establishing certain expectations. When I pick up a novel called The Princess Plan, with a woman in a modern ball gown on the cover, I'm expecting a modern royal romance. That's what I wanted to read, and I didn't get what I was promised. We've heard me rant time and time and time again about the quality of the covers on Harlequin. And this one really took the cake. I look at it and I'm like, I can't believe that it did this to me. Yes, it looks wonderful, but its blatant sidestepping of any attempt at historical accuracy infuriates me. There's two other novels in this series, and both covers are exactly like that. They're just these modern ball gowns for a Victorian romance. It's like, no. I really wonder how the author felt about it. Did she say yes to the cover? Like, was it, like, did it come across her desk and she went, yeah, that's fine? Or is it a situation that once the manuscript hits the Harlequin mailbox, it's completely out of her hands? For me, personally, if I was a writer who, you know, sent in these manuscripts for publishing, and I dropped it off at the offices, so to speak, and when I got the cover copy and I got this bait and switch cover slapped onto this, I would kind of be pissed. I am by no means a historical reenactor, but I've spent enough time around reenactors like the Renaissance Festival and SCA, and I know all those kinds of folks. I know the value in at least attempting some kind of historical accuracy. I am not asking for a picture perfect, historically accurate, down to the stitching costumes on these novels, because that does take time and a lot of money, but I am asking for some kind of effort, just something. I really wonder if that bait and switch cover had something to do with my apathy while I was reading The Princess Plan. I mentioned that I just was not engaged at all. I don't know, there might be something to say for the mental preparation when I start getting ready to get into a novel. And honestly, I do believe that the cover has a lot to do with it. A solid chunk of my reading selections are 90% based on immediate first impressions. What does the cover look like? What does the title tell me? And if both of those qualities catch my interest, I'll move to maybe reading the back blurb. And if it solidly hooks me and gets me engaged, I'm going to come home, or it's going to come home with me, or goes into the virtual shopping cart. I technically have two historical romances on the docket to be reviewed, with one from Harlequin, actually. It's been on the shelf forever now, and that's why I wasn't looking for one when The Princess Plan came across my screen. The cover didn't tell me that it was a historical romance, and the blurb didn't really clue me in either. I get that I might have missed the word Gazette, like I saw it, but and you'd think that should have been my big clue, but again, to me, it's not that unusual of a word that it raised any suspicion. Maybe a little old-fashioned, but I didn't think it would be super out of place. I think I mentioned in the episode, but really I thought I might get something like Gossip Girl with a royal slant. It's like, you know, a gossip gazette. Like, yeah, that's a thing. But now I think I know what you might be saying. If I had looked deeper into the product information on the site where I bought The Princess Plan, I might have avoided all of this. But the thing is, I don't want to do that. Let me explain. When I go into the bookstore in person, I'm not looking up reviews or author information if I'm unfamiliar with the author. I'm not even taking a peek at the pages before I buy it. I've known people who, like, you know, they'll read like maybe a page in the middle and they'll use that as like a metric whether or not they want to bring the book home. I want to be as blind as possible. I don't want to see the reviews. I don't want to know more about the author until I've read the book at least once. I want my initial first impressions to be as clean as possible. And then maybe I'll go hunting when I start writing the episode. I'll find things out. I'll even avoid reviews for as long as I can. A lot of sites, when they sell the books, they also like to post their first chapter excerpts. And I avoid those like the plague. I don't want to know about them. I don't need them getting in my way of making a choice whatsoever. So I've got the books, they're all right next to me on my bookshelf, and as an experiment, I grabbed The Princess Plan, and, you know, I opened it up to a random page, as one might when they're looking to buy a new book, and there was nothing on this particular page that would have tipped me off on the Victorian aspect, at least not right away. So, in theory, had I done a random page scan, I might not have even known then, especially if I already had an impression of a non-historical novel in my head. It's like looking at clouds. Sometimes you don't see the shape until someone shows you what the shapes there are to find. When we think about like the language that one would read for a Victorian romance novel, some novels have a more modern vernacular that they approach it with. I felt like The Princess Plan was a little bit more modern in its approach. But, you know, when you contrast it to something like, you know, Shifters of the Beau Monde with the Victorian Shifters, that was very, very Victorian language, at least it, my perception of it anyway. So I'm not fully absolving myself of the mistake of thinking that this was a novel set in modern times, but in my defense, the cards were stacked against me. In conclusion on this particular rant, don't judge a book by the cover, but understand the cover is still freaking important. But as for my apathy, I'm not willing to put it all on the result of getting a Victorian romance when I didn't want one. I won't say that I was bored by the story, because that's not true. And if it were true, this novel would have landed itself on the shelf of shame for the unforgivable crime of boring me. I've put novels there before for that exact reason. I'll do it again. I really, really wish I could understand why I was apathetic, because even now, I don't really know. Perhaps there's a lot of things going on that aren't related to this podcast that just kept floating to the top of my mind. I might not never know. It's unlikely that I'll revisit The Princess Plan, unlike some other novels that we read, again, The Shifters. So I resigned myself to accepting that maybe I just didn't like it all that much. But I still gave the novel a 4 out of 5, so never let it be said that I let my personal feelings get in the way of an honest review. So I don't really have a great segue for the next section of the podcast, so I'm just going to go ahead and drag us over to what Heather's been reading this week. Well, I did mention that there are a lot of things unrelated to the podcast that have been popping up, and it's been really hard to focus on finding a new book to read for, you know, general purposes. But I saw my eyes dropping down to a certain shelf containing certain novels in my personal collection. Ever since that I entered this particular fandom, it has been my go-to when things are just everywhere. When I needed something mindless, it's basically literary junk food. I read it just to get my mind off things. This process has served me well for what, oh god, 10 years, give or take. I started this in college. It's been a long time. I can trust these books to help settle my nerves and take some edge off my responsibilities, and I can just enjoy the spectacle. I'm talking about the Twilight Saga. Okay, before you get your pitchforks, I did not reread Twilight this week. I'm just setting something up here. But I would be the very worst of liars if I said that I didn't like those books. The thing is I know they're terrible. And that's why I love them. The melodrama, I guess, of a vampire slash human romance mixed up in this strange Mormon allegory of abstinence is hilarious and, for me, quite enjoyable. There's just something about Stephanie Meyer's work that reads like junk slash comfort food. It probably has something to do with the fact that when I discovered Twilight, I was neck deep in a literature degree trying to figure out what the hell my professors wanted when I was engaging in literary analysis, and I was just like struggling to write my own works for my creative writing courses. Like putting aloe on a sunburn, Twilight was a much needed and much unexpected mental balm. Yeah, there are a lot of things that are problematic about the Twilight Saga. I'm not going to sit here and try to defend Twilight as the perfect picture of young adult literature. I know that the relationship between Bella and Edward is creepy and not a healthy model for teenagers. Meyer's even like gone on the record, she's like, I don't think fictional people should be role models. I think she said that in an interview once. And her use of the real-life Quileute tribe is not great, but I can't help deny that the novels help chill me out when I need it. Before I go further, I do want to say that because of the context of the Twilight Saga, initially, I had no clue for way too long that the Quileute tribe was anything other than a fiction Meyer dreamed up. I thought it was like, it's not great that she's making up a tribe to make her story with, but... And then I find out that they're actually real, and she doesn't really acknowledge them in a lot of ways, or at least, you know, there's not a relationship between them. It's not good. And since I have learned this, it has changed some of my perspective on the books. It's dicey territory. Yeah, but I digress. Since I've read Twilight, I have gotten all of the movies. I've read her other novel, The Host. I've kept up with some of the small novellas that came with the Twilight. I actually quite like the graphic novels that came out, like as a companion piece. I wish I had kept going with them because they're really pretty. But I generally kept the books around simply for the fun of it. But there is one novel of hers that I have not read. So this week, I read her thriller, The Chemist. When The Chemist had come out, I think it was back in 2017, 2018, I really hadn't known it existed. I'm not the kind of Meyer fan that had alerts set up when she moved like a toe or something back at the height of her popularity. Like, I wasn't obsessed with her. So really, it passed me by. I did eventually learn about the novel, but I was never interested enough to pick it up. Until this week, when I just needed some junk food reading, and I really thought about reading Twilight again. And that's when I remembered that she had a novel that I hadn't read yet, so I decided to pick up The Chemist. Unlike her two previous franchises, The Chemist doesn't deal with any paranormal aspects. Instead, it's a sort of spy thriller, except without the spy, I guess? I mean, I might even call it, like, an anti-spy thriller, since our main character is not espionage exactly, and she's on the run from secret government organizations, and she's just trying to get through tomorrow. Our protagonist calls herself by any name except her own. The narration is actually quite interesting. Like, you know, whenever she adopts a new name, she calls herself that. Like, the third person will say, like, oh, today it was, like, Julia, or yesterday it was Alex or Christy. Most of the novel, she's saying that she's Alex. One character calls her Ollie because her code name in some circles was Oleander. But really, the chemist is really just a big theme of what she calls herself. We're really, anyway, she's got a medical degree, our character. We're going to call her Alex. And the government used her as an interrogator of sorts. She uses, like, a highly sophisticated concoction of chemicals and medicines to get her subjects to talk. It kind of makes a big deal about, like, you know, how she's the best in the business, that she had a 100% batting average when she needed to get what she needed. Until, that is, unbeknownst to her, one of her subjects spills the tea on some highly confidential information. She doesn't know that it's relevant. It was not part of the information she was trying to get, but the subject had slipped something with his words, and the organization, as she calls it, decides that she and her mentor were now liabilities. Her mentor gets killed, but he'd been super paranoid, and so that way she had been somewhat prepared to run. So that's what she did. She'd gone on the run, and she'd been running for 3 years. She's constantly on the move, she's surviving assassination attempts, and really she's just trying to disappear off the face of the planet. One interesting thing about her is that she sleeps with this insane booby trap of chemicals that'll gas her intruders, and she wears a mask, like a gas mask, as a result. It's bonkers. And that's basically her life until a colleague of hers gets in touch somehow. I don't know why she checks email for some reason. She checks email somehow, and she does it with this crazy ritual of going to a library 5 hours away from wherever she is. But he tells her that if she helps out the organization with one last case, they're going to get off her back. She reluctantly agrees, and using information provided to her, she kidnaps a guy that they've told her was preparing to unleash a massive bioweapon attack on the United States. So she nabs the guy, and when she works on the interrogation, she figures out that she's been had. Like, it was all made up, it's a ruse, in some roundabout way to try to kill her. This really comes into focus when the guy's twin brother, who is presumed dead, by the way, comes crashing through the roof in order to rescue him. Really, so, yeah, Meyer has an interesting knack for world building. Say what you want about Twilight, but you can't really deny that there's some really clever political world building with the vampire society. The Volturi itself is fascinating. And in her sci-fi novel, The Host, Her approach to the body snatcher concept is kind of enjoyable. If I were of the fan fiction sort, that would be a world that I would play with. But there's not as much fantastical world building in The Chemist, but it's still there. But unfortunately, Meyer falls into the same pitfall that has surrounded every other thing that she's written. All of that incredible detailed world building has to take a backseat to the mushy spark of something romance that she leans on to provide the drama in her stories. So Alex, our main character, she's nabbed her supposed target, Daniel, as they're on like a subway train. I think they're in DC. She makes it look like he's fainted using her crazy spy-like needles and medicines and whatnot. And since she's an actual legitimate medical doctor, she can talk her way into taking care of him. So she puts... Like, she grabs him, she takes him to the place where she does the thing, and she puts him through, like, serious pain. Like, it's actual legitimate torture. And for some ungodly reason, he still falls in love with her when the ruse is made known. It's like, when he's like, oh, well, of course you were doing this to find out a terrorist organization trying to set up a biochemical attack. That's completely reasonable that you would torture me with intense pain. Can I love you anyway? She doesn't even get it in the book. She's like, why are you like this? It's silly, it's unrealistic, and it's everything that I would expect from Stephenie Meyer. Now, and really, having read The Chemist, I can appreciate that Meyer didn't try to stick to one niche genre. She hit pay dirt with Twilight, and that allowed her to experiment with other concepts, and I know, like, probably a lot of people would kill for that kind of opportunity. Kudos to her for branching out, like, you know, instead of falling back on one thing. I mean, Twilight is still a bit of a crutch, but, you know. So, like, it's different. But other than the surprise release of Midnight Sun back in 2020, I don't think we've seen a lot of activity from her since The Chemist was released in 2017. Yeah, it was 2017. I'd say that I got what I was expecting from The Chemist, but really, if I need to go back to frilly nonsense again, my junk food literature, I'll probably just stick to Twilight. Heck, I might even just read Life and Death, which was the gender-bent version, and I personally think that one was a little more fun. So that will be it for me this week. I will see you all next time when we read Fit by Rebecca Weatherspoon. So thank you for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or want to recommend a read, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. And if you'd like, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It'll go a long way to help out the show, and I can keep bringing you lots of fun episodes. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kwang Yin Cho. Hopelessly Romantic is an HOK production. And it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.